This podcast is part of the Acast Creator Network.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hello and welcome to The Stand with Eamon Dunphy. Now, it is no secret that the Conservatives, the Tories in Britain, are expected to lose the next general election, which must be held this year or actually early next year. And the predictions are awful. I think the Tories have given up. Many of them aren't running again. And many of them, indeed, as recently as yesterday, are undermining the present Tory leader, Rishi Sunak. There have been a number of leaders since David Cameron left in 2016. We had Theresa May, we had Boris Johnson, we had a short stint. Liz Truss was Prime Minister for 45 days, and Rishi Sunak is the latest. The predictions on the next election, one of them by a respected polling outfit, gives the Tories just 100 seats, which would leave Labour theoretically on 400 plus. And that is pretty awful. And we're joined now from London by Chris Johns. Chris is former chief economist with the Bank of Ireland and now a very respected commentator. Chris, the Tories, there's no secret that they're going to lose the next election, but there are moves afoot, it seems, from within the party. They may lose the party altogether. This was the most formidable democratic vote-winning party in Europe for a very long time, over a century. Now it looks like the next election could see them in big, big trouble to survive, doesn't it?
Certainly, if the polls are right, we are going to get a Labour landslide. And as one commentator said only this morning, all Keir Starmer has to do now is just sit on the beach and read a book for the next 6-9 months. And provided that's all he does, he will be the next prime minister. He doesn't need to do anything. And indeed, that's exactly what he's doing. Absolutely nothing.
Yes.
But that's a different story. The fight is on for what the Tory party will become after that election defeat. The fight has started. So it's not just about who is going to be the leader, although, of course, that's a very big question, very important issue. It's, if you like, that old cliche, what will the soul of the party look like? And you and I have discussed this before. Will they try to go back to being One Nation Tories? Will they try to go back to being that ideology-free party that just simply is interested in achieving power and doing whatever is necessary to achieve power? Or will they become a bunch of right-wing ideologues? And at the moment, the people that are the most active anyway, the people that are making the most noise, it is the people on the far right of the Tory party who are winning. And we've had Liz Truss with her book this week. We've had a National Conservative Conference. You might remember we talked about the one in London a few months ago. There's one in Brussels sort of off and on this week. Various people on manoeuvres, Kemi Badenoch voting against Rishi Sunak's flagship project to ban smoking.
Yeah, and she's in the cabinet, and it is really not on, as they say.
Well, it was, in fairness to her and to Sunak, he made it a free vote, which yes. meant that people could vote with their conscience, vote how their constituents wanted them to vote, all that good stuff. But yes, collective cabinet responsibility normally, even in a free vote, would suggest solidarity with your prime minister who has sponsored the legislation. And in case anybody's wondering just why this is such a big deal, yes, smoking is a big deal in and of itself, but why now in the UK? In a funny kind of way, Eamon, I think Sunak's looking to his legacy. And,
yes.
you know, one of the things that Micheál Martin says that yes. he's most proud of is the smoking ban indoors in Ireland. And I think Sunak is thinking about in a few years' time, will people look back on him and not so much as the guy that stopped the small boats, but the guy that stopped smoking in the UK. And I think he is passionate about it, to use that overused yes. word. And he is looking to his legacy and he's thinking, well, I haven't been able to do anything else. I haven't been able to stop the boats. This perhaps is the last thing that I could leave that would have any kind of an impact over the next few years. So even he is thinking about legacy issues because he knows which way the opinion polls are going. I think that the battle is on. And so far, the people making the most noise and therefore making the running, if you like, and therefore most likely to win, are the extreme right.
Yes, and this reform group, and that's the name of the party, they, on a poll that was published last week, were getting 20% of the Tory vote. And they have, of course, Nigel Farage, and they are the old Brexit band getting together again to run. And Liz Truss, when she launched her book this week, she did say that it would be great if Nigel Farage was to join the Tory party. She, you would think, after a premiership that lasted all of 45 days, would not be a figure that many people would be interested in now. But she is still at the heart of it. She was talking about Donald Trump. She said she hoped he'd win the next US presidential election, which makes her very unique indeed in democratic politics in Europe, doesn't it, Chris?
Yeah, normally we don't, across Europe, make these kinds of comments about who should or should not win the next US presidential election. There are conventions, unwritten ones, that steer us away from this kind of thing. But she's settling a score there with Joe Biden, as much as anything,
right.
because Joe Biden made a comment about her disastrous budget that she introduced with Kwasi Kwarteng back in the autumn of last year that led to her downfall. And Biden essentially said, famously, while he was eating an ice cream in an ice cream parlor, actually, well, I'm paraphrasing slightly, well, I wouldn't have done that. He didn't think it was a good idea. And she's described that as the most extraordinary interference in British politics by a sitting US president. And she's returned the favor. And she
right.
has decided to try and interfere in US politics, which is interesting, as you say, because as several other commentators have pointed out, it's normally the winner that gets to write history, isn't it, Eamon?
It is, yeah.
And she is arguably one of the biggest losers in British politics in decades. And yet here we are, and all of the media here in the UK, at least, and Fox News in the United States and one or two other outlets there discussing her book. And it's called 10 Years to Save the West. And it has two basic ideas. One explored rather thinly, which is that the West is doomed unless somebody like Liz Truss is elected on both sides of the Atlantic. And as I say, there's a few pages about that. Mostly it's about how the British establishment did her down and saw to it that she only lasted 40-odd days in office. And she has nothing good to say about anybody in British politics, the economic establishment, the media, the Financial Times, the Economist get name-checked as being part of this deep state cabal.
Yes.
She's called for the dismissal of the Bank of England governor, Andrew Bailey, and the list goes on and on. And I haven't read the entire book. I've got it, and I've read a lot of the extracts, heard a lot of the podcasts when she's been speaking about the book, and it's a rollicking read. If you're interested in that kind of stuff, but at its heart are just loads and loads of contradictions. So she does support Donald Trump, to be the next president of the United States.
Their working assumption appears to be, Chris, that the United States and Britain are similar in terms of the constituencies and the voters, and that they can create in Britain a mirror image of the Republican Party as it is now, which is controlled by Trump, even the Congress controlled by Trump as well. Now, that may fall apart because of Trump's behavior, but there does appear to be a constituency that believes there is, for example, a deep state that believes, for example, that they manipulate the public, and that really, I think Trump has more or less said it, that next time there'll be no messing around with democracy. From day one, he's going to, for example, release the hostages, who are people who are in prison because of violent behavior on January 6th. They're not prisoners in Trump's eyes. They're hostages, and they'll be released. So no respect for law, and indeed no respect for anyone else except people who are dangerous. That doesn't exist in Britain, does it, Chris?
I think that's right, Eamon. I think there are clear similarities between Britain and the United States in several respects, and I'll mention one in a second, but there are very, very big differences. The similarity, I think, is the one of the forces that gave rise to both Donald Trump and Brexit. There was a common cause. It wasn't the only thing that gave rise to Trump or Brexit, but the fact that the so-called elites, the winners from globalization, the winners from economic growth, had left behind a lot of the losers and hadn't done enough. And the vast swathes of the northeast of England, the Midwest in the United States, the Virginia coal fields, the South Wales coal fields here,
yes,
all these sorts of constituencies were either big voters for Trump or big voters for Brexit, driven really by economics and being economically left behind.
Yes.
And so there were big economic drivers of both phenomena. But I think the political and cultural drivers are where we see divergence. The divided nature of America is not replicated to anything like the same extent here. Donald Trump has a base, a cult-like following that no matter what he does, no matter what he says, it wouldn't matter what policies he espoused, what beliefs he says he expressed, they would still vote for him. It is a cult.
Yes.
We do not have the same kind of political cult-like thing going on here. You could argue that the nearest that we have to it is Nigel Farage.
Or
perhaps
Boris Johnson, perhaps, Chris.
Maybe.
The return
maybe.
Of.
Mm. But Trump regularly polls in the high 40%.
Yes.
In terms of saying people would vote for him. That is not true of either Nigel Farage or Boris, or indeed anybody else for that matter. There is not that scale of the cult-like following. I'm not saying it doesn't exist at all, but we don't have that. And
yes,
I think that's a reflection. We don't have as deeply divided a society as we do in the United States, where it goes all the way back to the U.S. Civil War in the middle of the 19th century. It's if you look at the geography of the split in the United States, it's the coastal elites versus the urban, rural interior, for example. There are all these things going on in the United States that simply do not exist here, and it's partly wrapped up in both countries' history. We have far less political engagement in the United Kingdom, actually, than they do in the United States. It's very, very hard to imagine that whoever wins or loses the next general election, or indeed any of the ones that come after that, that the events of January the 6th that Donald Trump inspired would happen here. I just don't see it. I cannot see that level of political division.
Yes.
That said, of course, we go back to what we were saying earlier on, which is that part of the shtick, the raison d'etre, the way in which this far right thing operates, is that if you are going to try and set up the Tory party to be the British equivalent of what the Republican Party is becoming in the United States, that's the kind of division that you have to foster.
Yes.
One of the things that means that one of the ways to routes to success electorally is by sowing that kind of division, by getting it entrenched and getting people to vote as if their backs are to the wall and that they need to come out swinging.
Yeah, and the other thing, Chris, is the votes thing, the immigration.
We have a Rwanda vote today, I think, in Parliament.
Yes, and the idea of Rwanda is so absurd. But that is one of the common things that there is with the US. Immigration, the border problems that the United States has and hasn't solved. So that immigration issue, which Suella Braverman, who's another leading figure in this, what I would call a breakaway movement from the traditional English Tory. It's fair to say that Kemi Badenoch, Liz Truss, Nigel Farage, Jacob Rees-Mogg, these people are basically trying to destroy the sort of Tory party as it's been, are they not?
Well, this is where I think the issue becomes both clever and cynical. Because if you were trying to think, well, what is the issue that perhaps energizes this radical, potentially radical base that could be made to be as angry as people are in the United States? What is a common issue across many countries, not just Britain and the US? You have immigration debates, quite lively ones, going on in your country, Eamon. And of course, it's present all over Europe. And it's one of the things that these clever and cynical people see motivating people like Orban in Hungary.
Yes, he was speaking at that conference in Brussels today.
And so we know immigration is a live issue across many countries. It's common. So we know that it's a way of getting people energized politically. And if we can get people frightened of immigration, we can get them to vote for us, who will promise to stop it. And that's the basic deal that Trump and everybody else wants to do. And the way it's clever and cynical is that, of course, I don't think they really care about immigration one way or the other, actually, because it rarely impinges on them. For some of these people, ironically, of course, it has helped them because their ancestors were immigrants. I suppose if you go back far enough, all of our ancestors were immigrants of one kind or another. But the fact is, we know it's going to become a much bigger deal, if anything, going forward.
Yes.
Because if there is an explicit attempt, if you are sad enough to watch Moscow nightly news programs translated into English, you will see that one of the strategies of the Putin regime is to create another Ukraine immigration crisis for Europe next year. He's trying to dismantle the second city of Ukraine, and we've seen one wave of emigrants from Ukraine into Europe, and he wants to generate another even bigger one. There's an awful lot of people coming up from Africa. The number of people, number of Sudanese as a result, it was the first anniversary of their civil war, their latest civil war, it has to be said, this week, the one that doesn't get talked about very much. And just in the course of that year of that civil war, the number of Sudanese trying to cross the Mediterranean has gone up by a factor of six. There are lots of sources of immigration into Europe and the UK and Ireland over the next few years. And if you are a frankly horrible, cynical politician that wants to exploit the fears that come with that, then you do and say the things that these people on the right wing of the Conservative Party in that conference in Brussels, it's a national conservative movement that has all sorts of sinister roots in many different places around the world, principally New York and elsewhere. The list of speakers at these conferences is always the same, and they always, amongst the many things that they try to do, it's always a list of very predictable things that they do, is that they try to stir people up about immigration. And the thing about immigration, as I say, is that they're going to have an awful lot of ammunition over the next few years to deal with.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank.
LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Are they going to, are they capable of replacing the Tory party as we've known it? I mean, if there's the opinion poll, which you may or may not have seen, shows the Reform Party actually running ahead of the Tories.
Yeah, I have seen that, yeah.
Which is really, the Reform Party is the old Brexit band getting together again. Nigel Farage is very much the leading personality in it, although the leader is a fellow called Richard Tice, I think, who was a bad carrier in the Brexit movement. But they are really, if they destroy the Tory party, if they undermine it, and I think there's a chance that they may do that, I'm certain it's what they're trying to do. What will be left, Chris, to, if you like, to be the centre party, to be a humane and conservative party?
Well, this is a process, of course, that's been going on for a number of years. And the original Brexit referendum that was called by David, now Lord Cameron, was explicitly to defend the centre of the Tory party from,
yes,
from the right-wing attacks that were being launched both within the party and by Nigel Farage's Brexit party, UKIP, as it was called back in the day. So this goes back many, many years. And you can go all the way back to John Major in the 1990s talking about the right wing of the Tory party, and he referred to them as his bastards.
Yes.
And so this is a battle that has been going on for a long period of time.
Yes.
And the right wing part, one part, the bit of the two parties that have been fighting this war, one has lost and one has won. And the big victory that the right of the party achieved, of course, was the culmination of 40 years of effort to get Britain out of Europe.
Yes.
And having tasted red meat, they are now going for it. Boris Johnson accelerated the process when he purged in a neo-Stalinist way. I mean, he didn't take them out and shoot them behind the woodshed or send them to the Britain's equivalent of Siberia, but he did purge the Tory party of the one nation centrists.
Right.
And most of them are now gone.
Having spent most of his life agitating for one nation conservatism, despite his, what he did in office, he had never been regarded as right wing as such, had he?
No, absolutely. And one of the key ways to understand, I think, both British and American politics was put brilliantly by, of all people, and you'd probably be astonished I'll be quoting him here, Eamon. Do you remember John Bolton?
I do indeed. He was he's part of the neocons.
He was
an original neocon, and he was in Trump's cabinet, but they fell out.
He was interviewed on the BBC yesterday, and he was being asked about Israel and Iran and all of those issues that I know you cover elsewhere.
Yes.
And surprise, surprise, this very right-wing neocon was advocating the bombing of Iran and all sorts of extreme things, and criticizing Rishi Sunak for asking Israel to hold back, criticizing Joe Biden and all the rest of it. And all of that was very interesting. But the most interesting thing was when the interviewer turned to him and asked him about Donald Trump. And because he worked for Trump, he was in
he
the
did, yeah.
office.
He hates him.
And he was saying, he said, Donald Trump and Joe Biden, of course, but Donald Trump is unfit to be president. And he said, the reason why he's unfit to be president, everybody knows all about his legal cases and all that kind of stuff. But he said, the key thing to understand Donald Trump is that you've got to understand he doesn't actually have a coherent philosophy.
Yes.
So you cannot predict because this was the question, what would Donald Trump do next year if he's president with respect to the Middle East, with respect to Ukraine? You cannot predict, said Bolton, what Donald Trump will do, because even Donald Trump today can't predict it. Because on the day, the only question Donald Trump will ask himself is, what should I do now to benefit Donald Trump?
Yes.
Whatever the issue is. And that's the key similarity. I think there's a lot of insight in that comment, by the way. I think that's absolutely right. That, and Bolton was quite clear, quite logical. He was saying that Trump has no philosophy. He has no ideology. He has no coherent set of beliefs.
Transactional is what they call it.
100% transactional. Yes. And there he is very similar to Boris Johnson. Boris Johnson, I think, from a different perspective, he comes at it through his classical training at Oxford, where I think he took on the nihilistic form of philosophical belief that nothing really matters, and that therefore the only question to be asked is, what does it bring to the benefit of Boris Johnson, what I do next? And that explains his chameleon shape-shifting over the years, from being that one nation Tory, that very liberal mayor of London, because to be a mayor of London, you have to be a liberal in the old-fashioned sense of the word, to being this hard right-wing purger, neo-Stalinist purger of the Tory party. For to go through all that sort of sequence of events, I think it reveals that both he and Donald Trump are of one mind, that nothing really matters. The only thing that matters is me and the decision that I take today that benefits me.
Yes, indeed. And just let me ask you, Chris, before we finish our conversation, about how you see this playing out in Britain. There is no... The Brexit matter seems to be resolved, but the immigration matter isn't. What will happen in those red wall seats, we don't know. But many Tories who won seats on the basis of Brexit have actually said they're not running again. Some appalling creatures have emerged in the Tory party under Rishi Sunak on his watch, as it were. What's going to happen, Chris, do you think, to Britain if the Tory party is diminished to the point where Nigel Farage and Boris Johnson, for example, as a team, can take it over?
I'm very pessimistic, Eamon, for a very key reason. And I'm probably going to surprise you with this answer, because although I think that everything that I hear Truss say is absurd, it's flights of fancy, it's self-contradictory. She supports Trump and she supports Ukraine, for example. You can't do that. That, you know,
yes,
we know,
indeed. And she was a Remainer in the Brexit debate.
That's right. But her diagnosis of the problem is correct. The problem is the British economy hasn't grown for years and years and years now, 15 of them. Living standards have been either static or shrinking for 15 years now. And she says in her book and in her speeches and in her podcasts and many articles that she writes that the key problem facing Britain is the fact that the economy doesn't grow anymore. And I think she's right. As an economist, I think she's right. I think she's probably more right than she realizes. I disagree with her reasons why the economy hasn't grown, and I disagree with her policy prescriptions for getting the economy going again. But she is the only politician of any stripe, of any color, standing up and saying, this is what the problem is. It's a deep-seated, very structural problem that is leading to all sorts of political, social, and economic problems. The reason why we don't have enough money for public sector services, including the NHS, is because the economy is not growing and not throwing off the tax revenues. And I could make a long list of other problems. But you know, Eamon, she's the only politician that actually is willing to say that that is the problem. Keir Starmer doesn't say it. Rishi Sunak doesn't say it. And I can't detect anybody else that says it. And
it's if you the second actually, lowest growth in the G7.
If you don't fess up to your problems, as any therapist will tell you, you're not going to be able to do anything about them. And the reason why I'm pessimistic about the way things are going in the UK is that we will obsess about the small boats, about smoking, about immigration, about everything other than, you know, we obsess about trivia in terms of the grand scale of things, and we don't even acknowledge the real problems that we've got.
And a final question about Boris Johnson. This sort of emerging right-wing rump could effectively take over the Tory party, because Sunak will be gone post the election. And these people will be very prominent, and they have held a high office in Liz Justice Case, the highest officer of them all, even if it was only 45 days. But Suella Braverman was the Home Secretary. Kemi Badenoch is in the cabinet at the moment. Jacob Rees-Mogg was leader of the House. And of course, Nigel Farage was the man who delivered Brexit. Is there a possibility that what was effectively a decent party, the party of Harold Macmillan, you know, the party that of Edward Heath, who threw out Enoch Powell when he made a speech that was racist? What's going to become of that party, and what's going to become of Britain? And will Johnson come back is the question I really wanted to ask you, and I'm sure our listeners will be interested in your view of it.
He certainly wants to make a comeback, and every time he's asked, he refuses to rule it out. And his exact words are, not yet.
Right.
So I think he sees some kind of return, I would guess, in the midst of some crisis for either the country, the party, or both. The party that you describe, the risks that it runs about what it might become, and I think that you've got the tense wrong. I think it's happening. It's not what might lie in the future. What we observe is it becoming that right-wing thing that you are describing. So I'm saddened to say that, but Britain is, you know, sort of one great political party is becoming a party of the fringe, of the extreme. And I say that because I don't think that, short of some other crisis going on in the UK, you know, I don't see how that sort of political movement would attract enough support from what is a more centrist country than is the United States. That point about difference that I talked about earlier on, I still think that at heart, most British people are centrists, and the most intelligent people that I know that are political watchers, people like Lord Danny Finkelstein, an ex-Tory speechwriter, says that all elections in Britain are won from the centre. And I think that's absolutely right.
Okay, Chris, as always, it's fascinating to talk to you, and we're very grateful to you. That's Chris Johns. We're grateful to Chris, to all of you for listening. That's all we have time for now. We'll talk to you soon.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.